Hi folks, welcome to this premium podcast of the Lotus Eaters, where I'll be talking to Thomas about the origins of critical theory. This is one of those subjects that is often shrouded in mystery and myth, so we thought we'd cut through it, and this happens to be Thomas's area of expertise, does it not?
Yes, it is. I am doing a PhD at the University of York, Department of Philosophy. It started as an historical review and reconstruction of a concept called reification. It was basically a way of me conducting a Marxist critique of progressive politics, and it's ended up actually being based on, or shall we say, it's evolved to be a Hegelian theory of reification, because I think Hegel ultimately has a lot more useful things to say about how to deal with our social problems than Marx does. So that's my insights into the subject. It's ongoing. I'm in my third year now, just past my progression, and I get more excited by it the more investigate the rabbit hole. So yeah,
it's right. So critical theory then, where are we beginning?
Well, I thought it would be useful to explain my background into this, why it's been an interest to me from the start. It's not the academic discipline I started with. I actually started off pursuing a career in music and was doing a commercial music degree, a course that involved producing, performing. There was a strong focus on class conflict as well. Not only could I not make peace with the
music.
Class conflict in music.
Right. Okay.
In music, cultural criticism, you can't really separate class from the music that we enjoy today.
Right, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, it's I couldn't make peace with the industry's poor treatment of the artists, and I came to hate the value system implicit in it, to be honest. When I first read Theodor Adorno's essays on culture, and I regard Theodor Adorno as the high priest of critical theory, it became evident that my distaste for the culture industry was rooted in a Marxist position, commodity fetishism to be precisely. If you don't know what commodity fetishism is, it's the process whereby social relations become thingified. Like, for example, when you take a product to market, and the product is abstracted from the social process by which it came about, and the person who ends up consuming it has second to no knowledge about how it even came into existence.
So this is very much like leftists being sold the communist propaganda that they're currently buying from capitalist producers.
Yeah, yeah. I basically hated it for the simple reason that the music that people are ultimately enjoying isn't being enjoyed authentically. Like, no one knows anything about the artist. You've got a plethora of artists who are getting acclaim for things they've never done. And in the meantime, there are some very talented artists who actually end up selling their songs to awful people to perform and basically getting no credit for it. Lady Gaga was one of those for a long time before, of course, she became a nonsense in and of herself. But anyway, it's the culture industry's unashamed selling of, quite frankly, immoral, nihilistic, and ultimately destructive lifestyles to neurotic adolescents was what comprised my distaste for it. And I very much saw capitalism as the arbiter, really, of this nihilism. I was kind of astonished, really, that I suppose the left has come to like, for example, or at least fragments of the left seem to like subcultures such as grime, despite the fact that it seems to be almost a lumpen proletarian genre, given that it seems to have, wad posturing at every given opportunity. But anyway, that's just my gripe with grime. It's the music as it sounds now. This austere, socially conservative position that I ultimately had was what drew me to Marxist-Leninism and why capitalism had to be destroyed. So I hope that on capitalism's toppling, this awful, immoral amalgam of neurosis that we see, particularly with female artists and how they kind of present themselves in absurd sexualized ways. I just wanted this to end. It seems now, however, that the left is, for the most part, intent on selling this, or shall we say, setting this neurosis free of any constraints.
Yeah, well, that seems to be where they're going with it, isn't it?
It is, and that will involve making peace with capitalism, which they've been historically criticising, ironically.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, critical theory has proceeded to be my bread and butter and my gateway into philosophy as a whole. I'm delighted to be able to discuss it here. I thought it'd be best to start with the history.
Yeah.
So it came about at a very turbulent time in modern history, perhaps even the most turbulent time in modern history, finding itself in the middle of two forms of totalitarianism. You, of course, had the communism of the Soviet Union and the looming force of Nazism in Germany. It emerged as an intellectual practice within the Institute of Social Research, which was founded by Felix Weil in 1923.
This was located in Frankfurt, am I correct?
Located in Frankfurt,
yes. And this is where we get the term Frankfurt School.
Quite, yes.
It's not a conspiracy theory, is it?
It's not. Well, that depends what part of it.
Okay. Well, the existence of the Institute and the fact that people call it the Frankfurt School, that's not a conspiracy.
The existence of the Frankfurt School is not a conspiracy. They're an official offshoot of that Institute.
Right.
And they established themselves in 1929 and, of course, got their name through the Institute's relation of the University of Göttingen, Frankfurt. It was the Institute, before the Frankfurt School, was founded because the German left-wing intelligentsia was in a crisis. The Soviet Union, under the directorship of Stalin, had failed to actualize the utopian society that Marx and Lenin envisioned. And, the Weimar Republic, that is the government founded, that came about after Germany was defeated in the First World War, was still grappling with Prussian exceptionalism, hence the anti-Semitic undercurrent still present in its culture at the time. And this meant that Western Marxists were in a suffocating position. They either had to accept the social democracy of the Weimar Republic and thus abandon any commitment to revolution, or align themselves with Moscow's leadership through the German Communist Party, who were Stalinist apologists, basically.
Yeah.
And they saw the Weimar Republic as an awful bourgeois compromise. Well, the Frankfurt School decided to do neither of those things, neither to apologise for Stalin nor to accept this bourgeois compromise. Hmm. The problem, as they saw it, wasn't with Marxism. Marxism's not the problem. The problem is Marxist-Leninism.
Right. I view Leninism as a crisis, an earlier crisis of socialism, for failing to bring about a proletariat revolution.
As in
Marx's prediction was wrong.
Yeah.
Proletariat are deeply reactionary.
Yeah.
And so they need to have the Bolshevik revolution, the vanguardism.
Yeah.
And so after that, there's another crisis because that turned out not to produce communism either.
Yes. And their argument for that was that proletariat that Lenin got together was inherently reactionary. And that's because the science had a bad idea of how the proletariat should exist.
Yeah.
So they basically thought we've got a better idea than this.
Yeah. Lurching from crisis to crisis, the history of socialism.
Yeah, and they said the meiosis of the Marxist-Leninist model is caused by the nature of its narrow materialistic basis, where the case of revolution is made almost entirely on economic grounds, off the back of what is known as political economy, such as that of Adam Smith, Ricardo, etc. And what the three most important figures of the Frankfurt School, that is Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Herbert Marcuse, proceeded to do was to try to reintroduce the historical basis from their perspective. Lenin neglected in his understanding of Marx. Marx was, of course, a materialist himself, but had a more sophisticated philosophy kind of was underpinning his materialism. So let's investigate this departure of Marxist-Leninism. So
Lenin was a committed materialist himself, though, right?
Oh, he was. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's just his materialism was bad.
Well,
so the, at least to the
you could say about a lot of materialism, I think.
Yes, you could. Well, yes. But the Marxist-Leninist line is as follows. Bourgeois society is defined by its being comprised of those who own property, those who do not. The property owners make up the bourgeoisie. The non-property owners make up the proletariat. So given that the proletariat are dependent on the wage contract to attain their means of subsistence, there's an unfair power dynamic that falls in favour of the bourgeoisie, which means they have an incentive to perpetually intensify the labour process, suppress wages, etc. And this wage contract for Marx is the crux of the proletariat's exploitation, as the fixed return they receive for their variable labour means that they get a rate beneath what they generate for the bourgeoisie. That's why they believe that property equals theft and that capitalism is
why you hear profit is theft from communists.
Yes, repeated constantly. And this is accepted across all schools of Marxism. It's just a matter of what science you subscribe to, really. But because the bourgeoisie abstract themselves from the production process, they're actually not doing it. They own it, but they're not doing anything within it. They have insufficient knowledge of it to the Marxist. And for that reason, under their ownership, capitalist society is always destined to fall into crisis. But the proletariat, on the other hand, because they literally run the means of production, they have absolute knowledge of that production process. And this is essentially what justifies the dictatorship of the proletariat as the end of history. And from this point, you can, of course, draw a strong distinction between Rousseau's general will, this idea that there can be no antagonisms, you know, within a state that has the people, people,
whatever the people
as its subject.
Yeah. So I find this deeply ironic that they're complaining about the crisis of capitalism, but capitalism has been pretty strong for hundreds of years now, and socialism is lurching from crisis to crisis, unable to resolve its own contradictions.
Yes.
Ironic.
But the Frankfurt School do find this to be problematic, or at least...
What a shock.
Yeah, what a shock. And this is predominantly because Lenin neglects all he said. He neglects the historical dimension of Marxist philosophy of history. And well, he confines his theory, this is Adorno's criticism, to fixed premises, which Adorno later refers to as transcendence presuppositions.
Right, okay.
And things that you just assume out of thin air, they're fundamentally abstract. So one of these is that the narrow is his narrow explanation of the class conflict between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Another is the idea, this idea that the proletariat have such an epistemic advantage because they're just literally doing it. Adorno hates this idea that because the proletariats have absolute knowledge of the production process, they have to run it. It's rooted in a completely false idea of how people just react to their work, or shall we say, the general relationship between subject and object. It almost implies like a non-conceptual relation, which is absurd. But
okay, well, hang on. Let's slow down there. Because if I recall, was it Dialectical Enlightenment or something like that, where Adorno talks about the capitalist man, the guy who's buying his beer, watching his football game, and he's a product of capitalism, and he can't be anything else.
Yes.
So we're in this territory now, right?
We are. I mean, that's a bit further ahead from where I am at the moment.
Right,
that refers to the concept of reification,
right,
which we're going to get to. That's precisely where...
I don't mean to interrupt, but you're going very quickly.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
But in short, the Frankfurt School wanted to... agreed that a new method of deconstruction was needed to explain why capitalism was bad. They knew it was objectively bad, but believed that a more comprehensive framework of a focus on the cultural elements was required. And they did this.
So just pausing there. So when you say they knew that it's bad, I take it this is just based on the presupposition that it doesn't bring about communism.
It's based on the idea that you need an exploited class in order for it to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why it's objectively bad.
Yeah. So, but I mean, the essence of that is just saying, well, this isn't communism.
You could say that, I suppose.
Because I mean, the ideal of communism being the stateless, classless, propertyless society where no one's exploited for anything. I mean, everything that's not communism is bad by this standard.
Well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, there is an appeal to an abstract universalism there. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
No, it's okay. But the nature of this new method of deconstruction can be identified. By referring to a distinction in German idealism. And one of these are Verstand and Vernunft. Verstand refers to the understanding, reason. Well, Vernunft refers to reason. And it's quite simply refers to like closed and open systems. Right. They refer to two different epistemologies or forms of knowledge. So closed systems, put simply, work from these positive transcendent claims and therefore conceptualize the phenomena in direct accordance to those presuppositions. They quite literally make what they find fit into that presupposed model, whereas Vernunft effectively challenges how those very presuppositions constantly.
Summarize this in layman's terms, because I'm not familiar with these terms and I've not read about them.
Okay, so Verstand basically has these are the rules. This is in effect what we believe. This is how experience is comprised, whereas Vernunft is this system that's constantly questioning those categories of experience.
Right. Okay.
And you could compare it with the Kantian epistemology and the Hegelian epistemology. Kant's epistemology, Kant's philosophy of experience comes from emerges from the transcendental unity of apperception, where you have these concepts of the understanding, these unchanging concepts, which Kant just assumes to be universal amongst all rational beings. Hegel says, and of course we need such concepts for these for objective knowledge to be possible, but you haven't justified why these concepts are the way that they are. Surely they're historically conditioned, and there's a method implicit there where you're constantly challenging these presuppositions, and you do that by virtue of criticizing claims that are made on the very terms that those claims are made. So it's a philosophy of contradiction. And basically the Frankfurt School method is to criticize capitalism in this way. It's an entirely negative method. So in that sense, it doesn't actually propose anything positive of its own. I suppose the implicit idea among the Frankfurt schools is communism is just the solution. That's not Adorno's position necessarily, as we'll see later on. But that was that's what the distinction ultimately is.
So this, as you say, it's got no sort of constructive drive contained within itself. It's purely about criticism of what is,
yes,
rather than the presentation of an alternative.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's like, imagine if you were in a relationship like that, you know, and all, well, that just sounds like it's just being like negged, you know, you're constantly being told you're bad, but nobody's ever producing a constructive alternative.
That's quite right. But the reason for that is that the the critical fear is basically the belief this is the only way you can hold ideologies that, that impose themselves to account.
So this isn't necessarily just about capitalism, then. This could be about anything.
It could be about anything. Right. I mean, they point the finger at capitalism consistently because that's the thing that is. Yeah. And but ultimately, it could apply to literally anything.
Right.
Yeah.
But why would you want to do that?
Well, because then I suppose you no one has a monopoly on the ideologies that continue to pertain. It's a way of holding people to account constantly. I mean, it's appealing to a sphere of communicative rationality.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.